Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I am delighted to be joined today by Mark Phillips. Mark first got into recruiting in the late 90s, same as me, and has specialized in the education technology industry since 2006. He launched his own firm in 2010, and by 2019, had built it into a $4 million per year business. As a member of Sanford Rose Network, Mark has coached and developed his recruiters to success, including having three rookies of the year, two top recruiters in the network, and multiple top 10 in the network performances. His firm recruits for education companies, so not schools, but companies that sell products and services to pre-K, K-12, and higher education institutions. Mark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, so glad to be here, Mark. Thank you for having me, and thanks for that introduction.
My pleasure. So I should hopefully be able to remember your name at least. Apparently it's derived from Marcus and has something to do with Mars, the Roman god of war. Do you know anything about that?
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to tell people that now.
It's like, exactly. You're supposed to be like a warlike or something. I don't know. Something silly like that. But
my father was a Baptist minister, so I'm 99% certain it was because there right. was an apostle named Mark.
Of course there is. Yeah, of course. That is a logical explanation. So listen, you were introduced to me by our mutual friend, Jordan Rayboy. And Jordan is a very great friend of the podcast. He's been on the show twice himself, and he's referred multiple guests to us, and always have they been of the highest quality. So really looking forward to this. How do you know Jordan?
Well, probably like most folks, I first encountered Jordan just through some of his training, right? There were a number of videos that I saw, you know, sort of at some point along my career that, you know, talked about excellence, that talked about performance, that talked about planning. I remember the power planning video that I watched very well. And I think I still show that to my people on a pretty regular basis. And then, I also should say that, like, just his story, his very non-traditional approach to business, the story of being on the bus and out, you know, in the mountains and really, you know, sort of structuring work around a life that he wanted to live and enjoy, that really appealed to me. I've always, you know, probably like a lot of recruiters, thought of myself as a little bit outside the mainstream, a little bit of a nonconformist. So that really appealed to me. And then he came to speak at one of the first SRA gatherings after we joined. And I think we joined in 2013 or 2014. And he and I just hit it off. I just feel like in a lot of ways we're kindred spirits, and it's just been really interesting to see how our lives and how our businesses have tracked and encountered similar things. So I just always feel like he's somebody I can approach at a really intimate level with business or with life issues, questions, Or, you know, and I think the reverse is true too, or the, you know, he has the ability to sort of approach me with the same kinds of inputs.
Amazing. Yeah. He's just such a super guy. And, I've definitely benefited from the association. You mentioned something about recruiters being nonconformist, and that's not something I've ever heard articulated before, but it did resonate for me. Could you say more about that? Like, what are you basing that on?
I guess maybe just my experience, my own experience, my own lived experience, but then my experience hiring people, and seeing people sort of come through this career. And it feels like a job category, that you don't need a lot of pre-qualifications for, right? I mean,
true.
I've heard somebody in my career say that that's true of most services. But you know, it really kind of, it's a far more individual pursuit than a lot of careers, or at least a lot of the careers that we sort of engage with as headhunters, right? I mean, I'm working with candidates who have 20, 25, 30 year careers in the education technology sector, and they've taken a very different path than I have. And, you know, I can, there's just something really responsive about a career in recruiting. Financially, professionally, from a work-life standpoint, right? I mean, you can, it's like fishing. It's like you could go and work 100 hours a week for a summer and then take the rest of the year off and have a really successful recruiting practice if that's what you wanted. You could recruit 20 hours a week if you wanted and have a very successful recruiting practice. Like it just feels like it's a career that can take whatever shape you want. And I think it attracts people who appreciate that, who for whatever reason felt like they knew better or they didn't fit in more traditional environments. And, you know, I studied poetry. I was a lit major and graduated in the recession in the early 90s. So my education, you know, coming out of high school and my educational endeavors, I felt like I was different. And there was just something about recruiting that felt like it scratched that itch and continues to, you know, these many years later.
That is so interesting, Mark, because I am going to reflect on that, because I have always felt different, like a bit of an outsider. And, but I didn't really necessarily even think of that same mindset applying to people who are attracted to recruiting. I certainly feel that it is a common trait of people who decide to go it on their own and start up their own firm.
Yeah.
With, you know, no doubt, but maybe even all recruiters to some extent are, you know, break the mold a little bit. It does attract a colorful cast of characters and personalities. So yeah,
there might be something to that. And it makes sense, right? I mean, we have, and it could be true of just sales careers in general. I probably need to sort of think about that before I make, you know, before I make even more sweeping statements. But like, we have to do stuff that captures people's attention and seduces people to engage in a relationship with us. And, you know, with all the noise in the world, like we're competing with an infinite number of inputs that people are getting. So I it kind of makes sense to me. Like there's something, you know, we want to engage with people that are interesting to us.
Yeah. But I almost feel, I wonder if that in some ways for me is a handicap. Like if I don't, because I don't build rapport with people on the basis of having common interests or experience, right? Which you know, I connect with people on a, like, as one human to another and try and find that common ground, but I can't talk about, like I live in Scotland, but I do not play golf. I don't watch football or soccer, as you guys know it. I don't drink at all. So drinking scotch doesn't appeal to me. So like finding things to talk about with people, I immediately have to discard the standard things that people would find to talk about with each other.
And that's very nonconformist. That's kind of, I feel like maybe you're a great example of the dynamic that I'm trying to describe. And I think about one of the first really sort of big relationships that I cultivated in my current industry in education technology. And there's a guy who's a dear friend now. His name's Brett. He's been to my wedding, and we vacationed. My wife and I have vacationed with he and his wife. Not to get too political, but you know, I tell people I'm left to Bernie, right? And if you are aware of American politics, you're aware that there's a little bit of shock value to saying that. But I also, it's probably true. Like if you like took a policy card.
That's funny, especially for a business person to say that as well, like puts you in your own little category.
And I'm dealing with people who are absolutely not left of Bernie. And I'm thinking of Brett, and I'm thinking about a conversation that he and I had when I first met him, and it was the first time we got together for dinner. I think he was my first client. I think he was, you know, somebody I cold called. I made two placements. They were really good placements. He was impressed with me. I was, you know, far younger than I am now. And that was a big deal to me. So I said, hey, let's get together for dinner. We did. And we had this kind of authentic connection like you described. Like, we didn't talk about sports, you know, weren't talking about, you know, a lot of golf, a lot of the things that often populate business discussions. And at some point he called me a pinko. and he said it with affection, and it was just really wonderful. And I think that's such a great example of how I like to engage in relationship with people. And I think that's, you know, that makes me a really good recruiter. And it sounds like you have a really similar kind of way. Like it's interesting, we as recruiters, we're asking people very intimate questions about their lives very early in a relationship. Like I'm asking them how much money they make, or actually not so much that anymore, given legal restrictions, but I'm engaging in a very personal conversation about their income.
Yes.
Within minutes of meeting them. Like that means I have to send signals of trustworthiness. I have to send signals of authenticity. Like this isn't, I'm not just using this information to, you know, as a lever for something else. Like, and I don't know. I think the good recruiters, like that's a superpower for them, for us, for you, for me, like our ability to maybe avoid traditional trappings of interests and really get at the heart of like the people.
Okay. I'd like to follow this thread because this is not on my list of things to ask you about today, but since it's come up, like, how do you do that? Like what is your approach to building trust with people quickly and creating that connection so that they do feel comfortable opening up to you and talking about their ambitions, their issues in their current situation, what they're happy with, what they're not happy with, and, you know, then allowing you to guide them to something potentially better?
It's interesting. I think that, I don't know if it's going to be a super organized response. So I think you have to have a real keen ear for defensiveness. And you have to immediately be aware if you have asked a question in a way that's, you know, that's pushing somebody into a defended territory. And you just got to be, you just have to have a real knack for communicating, asking a question, communicating the information, asking a follow-up, maybe pushing them a little bit. You have to have a keen ability to do that without, and while also saying, hey, we're in this together. Like, I don't win. I don't win if you don't win. Like, you know, it's the classic sort of sales concept of win-win. I don't really, like, that's not in my, in the front of my consciousness when I'm talking with folks, but it's certainly a dynamic that I'm 100% engaged in all the time. And like, there's so many bad actors in the world. Think about the email. Yes. Think it's just about like navigating your inbox, like how quickly you have to decide, oh, that's not worth my time. Yeah. Oh, that's spam, or it's not spam, but you know, there's 10 minutes I'm not going to get back if I answer it. So like, we're just flooded with stuff that we're having to measure against our personal interest all day long. And I have to assume that that's true for everybody that's on the other end of the call, the other end of the Zoom. And I just have to be really good at keeping an ear for it and quickly backing away and saying, hey, just heads up, sounded like that landed wrong. I want to make sure that I'm, you know, operating as an agent for you, because if I'm not, this doesn't work. So you can have any answer that you want, and we can decide, you know, we could decide on a universe of outcomes of this conversation, but I just need to know that, I need you to know that I'm not successful here unless you're successful. So I don't want this to feel like this is the Mark show. I use that language a lot. I don't want you to feel like this is a Mark show. I use it internally with my team. I use it when I'm hiring people. And I also, that's specific language that I use in recruiting calls. Does that get toward an answer to your question?
It does. And it sounds like it's a combination of just sort of natural, you know, innate desire to, and curiosity and interest in people. But then you mentioned there's some language patterns that you use, and you shared one of them, like, this isn't the Mark show. This is about me being your agent and us, you know, this has to work for you. Are there any other shortcuts or structures or phrases that you find helpful in order to create that rapport?
If you listen to call recordings of mine, probably 75% of the statements that I make, I follow up with, how does that feel? How does that land? Give me some feedback. Does that make sense? Like, I'm constantly, I feel like I'm, the pattern is very much kind of baby stepping toward whatever objective. Like, I don't have, you know, I don't have this kind of waterfall, you know, start here and at the end you get a qualified candidate or a signed contract. It's not really sort of explicit, but I do feel like you take baby steps and you confirm that you're on the same page at every point. So I think that's like, tell me more is another really good one. That's especially when they're talking. I use that a lot. Tell me more, or even I do this with my family a lot, and sometimes they tease me. When somebody else has the talking stick, I'll say, you know, and just leave it there. Just And people like to talk. People like to talk, and they like to feel like you're interested in them. And is just this kind of rich statement of interest in what they're saying and how they're saying it and what they might have to say next. So those are some other tools that I think are on in pretty regular rotation with me. those are the ones that are, that are, that are.
Yeah. Come quickly. No, that's good. That's good. And, you mentioned call recording. Is that something you do for, as part of your either personal development or teaching your team members?
We do. As you well know, and I'm sure most of your guests will know, call recording is a legally complicated issue in the United States. There are multiple states and even different municipalities that have different policies, different laws surrounding call recording. So we do have call recording on all the time, but we don't announce. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if I should be saying this publicly. We don't announce that we don't announce that the calls are being recorded, and we never it's literally just for us to sort of review and learn from. It's not
definitely. I think it's so valuable, and we actually have a relationship with a company, and I'm going to need to rack my brains to remember what they're called, but they had a really cool software platform where they record all your calls, and like they integrate with whatever RingCentral or whatever cloud-based VoIP platform you're using. And they allow you to analyze those calls, but using AI so that you don't have to literally listen to every call. Because if you've got a team of four or five people on the phone all day, you couldn't wade through all those calls, right? But what it does is, first of all, it transcribes every call and looks for keywords. And it will then tell you, for example, in Mark's call today with Bob, Mark was talking 72% of the time and Bob was talking 28% of the time. That's the ratio should be the other way around, right? Or how many open questions he asked or key phrases that you've told the AI to look out for, and so then it will bring calls to your attention that it thinks you should listen to. But the goal really is to accelerate people's development so that they get to hear like the greatest hits of Mark Phillips, and what a good call sounds like, and have multiple examples of that. And then of course the reverse is also useful, so people can get coaching and all, even self-coaching on listening back to a call that didn't work out and then trying to figure out what should I have said differently or what other question could I have asked that might have, you know, been more productive here. And I just think it's such a valuable resource. And it's like, if you're doing it just on RingCentral, it's free, right? It's just a free training resource that's really, really useful.
So I've looked at a couple of those tools. One is gong.io.
Okay.
And I think the other one is called chorus, .ai, okay, maybe. That's on my list for, next calendar year. It's a big enough expense, that I hadn't budgeted for it this year. And we're really focused on hiring and building out some training capabilities this year. So I love the idea, and the demos that I've seen of the product get me really excited. You know, I sort of spin off into all the possibilities that could come from it. And I think, I should say that, you know, next year, my primary job will be opening new markets. So that's a shift that's happening in our company right now. And I think that kind of resource, when you're opening new markets, like a lot of those business development calls, a lot of those initial recruiting calls are going to be mine, because I'm trying to figure out what is this, where's the juice, you know, what's the real opportunity in this new market. And maybe there's none. I've expanded into a couple different markets where there wasn't a there. And so having a resource like Gong or Chorus or whatever tool like that, I think that's awesome. I'm really excited about it. We chose not to spend money on this year, but it's absolutely top of list for next year.
Cool. Those are good resources, and I'm going to need to rack my brains while we're talking to figure out the name of the company that may be worth you checking out as well. Richard Smith is the, well, it's like the business development director and co-founder. So they wrote a great book, which we should mention as well, which is about prospecting. So the book is called Problem Prospecting, which is worth checking out on Kindle or on, in fact, there's not an Audible version yet, unfortunately, but on Kindle, check out Problem Prospecting. The company is Allego or Allego. So it's Allego.com.
Awesome.
So add that to your list of demos. Mark, I'd love to know, like, I guess first big question is growing a firm from nothing to $4 million run rate. Could you talk me through that journey and how you achieve that? Because that's fantastic. And most people never are able to pull that off. So I'm really interested to hear how you did it.
So like a lot of firm owners, I was just a really good recruiter. And I was, you know, I thought enough of myself that I thought I could do it better. And so I started my own firm. Right. So, but it, at my heart, at my core, like, I'm a producer. And I think that's true of a lot of recruiting firms. And I think that's why a lot of recruiting firms don't sort of break that event horizon. Right. Yes. For me, that threshold was right at about $1 million, just under $1 million. And we, like, from 2010 to 2013, maybe 14, like, we got up to the high 100, so just under $1 million, and we kind of stuck there. And I knew that I wanted to build, when I started the firm, I knew I wanted to build a firm that would attract and keep people like me, right? I felt like there was something that I could do as a firm owner that would make it, whether it was comp or lifestyle or responsibility or making investments in growth or whatever. I knew that I wanted to build a company that would attract really good producers and then not lose them to starting their own firm. But I kind of hit a wall around $1 million. I had had some early training from Jeff Kay and Karen and Nick. And this is pre-SRA. I went to, in fact, this was right after I started my firm. I went to a Next Level Exchange Owners Forum, I think they called it at the time. And that was a central part of their message. It's like, how do you grow a firm that attracts and retains top producers? So I took a lot of their lessons. And a really big one that I remember early on was hire in threes. Remember the rule of threes. So don't just hire one, because then you get over leveraged and overcommitted to somebody, and you can't sort of flex. And, you know, not everybody, this job is weird, and you're going to be taking risks on people and hiring based on aptitude. So you need a volume play, the same way that you need a volume play when you're making a placement, right? You need multiple candidates in for a gig. You need multiple candidates as you're building your firm, because not everybody is going to love it and not everybody's going to be good at it. So that was a really big early lesson that I implemented. And, you know, and then there were others from the perspective of comp plans, from the perspective of, you know, another core message that that crew, Jeff and crew, talked about was being market masters. And my industry was really perfect for that. It's a relatively small industry. You know, I don't feel like I can say to you with 100% certainty, this is my addressable market, but I think that it's about 2,000 companies. And right now we have between 300 and 500 contracts that we've signed in the entirety of our history. So if those numbers hold up, and if we assume that all of those contracts really are, you know, sort of customer engagement, then I'm at about 25% market penetration. You know, yes. I probably can't be much more than 50%. Otherwise, there aren't sources, right? So Jeff and crew really suggested be a market master, own your space. And so we started messaging that to clients, and that was good at getting us up to 1 million. And I kind of, like I said, I think we had 2 years where we were, you know, we kind of plateaued, but like we got up to, you know, 800,000, kind of plateaued there. And I went back to an owner's forum, like, hey guys, I put all the stuff that I learned into play that got me here, but it's not getting me to the next level. And that's when they pitched me on joining the SRA network. And I think they being the K Bassman and Next Level Exchange organization bought the SRA network in like 2012, took a little while to sort of figure it out. And then they decided, you know, we want growth-minded recruiters, you know, and I fit that mold. And so I was at the owner's forum. They took me out, said, hey, this is what we're doing. You know, we're trying to attract people like you. Would you sign up? It took me 6 months to decide to do that. And so then they became a really big part of my thought leadership. And so all those rules that I had, you know, the rule of three and be a market master and decide how you want to architect your firm, those were all still in play. And I think what got me from 1 million to a 4 million run rate was we implemented a partner program. we offered people the opportunity to earn a partner title by with production. And I think at the time it was $400,000 a year in annual production. If you bill 400, you get the title partner, and we celebrate you. We announce that to our market, so that has some benefit to them as they're talking with candidates and clients. And then we did partner retreats. Mm-hmm. We were at the place that we were offering partnership, meaning true ownership in the company that was tied to being a partner title. We were at that level when things fell apart. At the end of, really at the end, they were kind of falling apart January of 2019. And then, by May, they really fell apart. And by August, I was back to being a single producer. There's a rich story there, but just a couple more bullet points on the path from one to four. We got a partner program, which we believed was a strong incentive for producers. We got really rigorous about hiring regularly. We had very defined territories that allowed us to hold people accountable to territory coverage.
And is that a geographic territory, or is it a sort of sub niche within the education technology space, or how do you define a territory?
Okay. Both. So we divided, we looked at our database, we went back and looked at deals, and we kind of saw some patterns. And, you know, our industry has a pretty neat separation between companies that make money from K-12 institutions and companies that make money from higher ed institutions. There's a little bit of overlap, but really not, less than 10%, right? So that was a really easy division to make. We're going to have a higher ed team and we're going to have a K-12 team. And K-12 does pre-K and higher ed does adult learning. But those were really peripheral kind of businesses. And then I think originally we created three different territories. And honestly, like the business logic, not to get way too in the weeds, but this might be interesting for folks as they're considering territories, the business logic was, how do I ensure, like, how many companies can I assign to a recruiter and make sure that they're touching them at least once a quarter? And right. I think we did the math. This is sort of digging deep in the archives, but I think we did the math and we're figuring, hey, if you're just doing 5 outbound connections with companies per day, that equaled somewhere between 200 and 300 companies. And then you're covering all those companies over the course of the quarter. Again, don't hold me to the math, but I think it ended up being about 200 to 300 per. So we assigned, we looked at where those existed. Then we created geographical boundaries. The first swipe that we took at that was a little weird because we're very, our industry, you know, really traces back to publishing companies and they're very coastal, right?
Yes. I was going to say, like, isn't there going to, like, the person who gets New York as a territory or San Francisco as a territory, they're going to be, have a disproportionate concentration of technology companies, right?
Yes. We didn't have anybody living in those territories. So there wasn't like an unfair advantage that you could go out and meet with all those people in New York, but we did structure it around that way. So there might have been, there might have been 200 companies between New York and Boston, but there also might have been 200 companies in all of the Midwest and all of the Southeast. And that's how we shaped our territories. So it was really, we had the industry, K-12 higher ed, and then we had a grouping of companies that ensured that people could touch them once every quarter. There's some pros and cons there, and that is an issue that we are confronting again now. And frankly, I think most any growing firm, they're going to be kind of addressing that issue probably twice a year. Just because you want coverage, but you also want to reward hustle and you want to reward production.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So you want to provide enough protection for your people, but not so much that they just feel entitled to it and they're not really working it. So there's always push and pull. And, but that's how that played out for us to get from 1 to 4. Let me think if there's another.
So to recap, and by the way, when we talked at the beginning about building rapport, one of the things that occurred to me in terms of being a good conversationalist is, first of all, recapping on what the other person has said and make sure you understood correctly. And then secondly, signposting where you'd like to structure the conversation next. So the three biggest things you shared were like market mastery. Number two is hiring in threes so that, you know, because it takes the same amount of time to train 3 people as it does to train 1 person, but you're giving yourself a 300% better chance that at least one of them is going to work out, right? And then if you lose 1 or 2 out of 3, then your whole training process hasn't been completely wasted. And then the thirdly was structuring the way that you reward people and promote people to create retention and keep your best producers. Was there anything that I missed?
And then just having kind of an organized approach to your market, I guess that might fall under the market mastery category. It probably does. The one other thing that I'll add that just occurred to me is I also hired an assistant who has been with me the longest of any employee. She's being promoted to CEO January 1st.
Fantastic.
So, yeah. So that's a big move for our business, but it really has its roots in kind of understanding what some people do well and what others don't do well. I have never, probably like most headhunters, like the operational details of the business, are, I like, there's, there are very few things that bore me as much as that, you know, and very few things that I have, you know, I feel like I can do a lot of things really well. Like the operational details are not my strong suit. And so I, acknowledging that, putting somebody trustworthy, like when I hired Katie, and this was back in 2014, and that may sound weird because I said I lost everybody, and I'll explain that in a minute if you want. But when I hired her, I said, your first job is to manage me. And your second job is to manage my inbox. Like, I do not want to be in my emails, but I need to know that important stuff that's coming into email is being addressed.
That's okay. So two things about this. Number one, if you have not read Rocket Fuel by Gino Wickman, it's definitely worth reading. Do you know that book already?
I do. And we use EOS to a very large degree. That's the framework for our leadership meetings, for sure.
Great. Yeah, we love EOS. My friend Joel Slenning and I run a mastermind group for owners who have firms who want to scale called Apex. And some of, like, we do borrow and some principles in terms of strategy and structure from EOS. But I can totally, when I read Rocket Fuel, I was like, oh my goodness, like, this is so true. Like, I do not personally have all of the skills and competencies and interests that are required to really grow a company. And I need somebody else to help me. And so that person for me is my colleague Leanne, who has very complementary skills to me. And of course there's overlap and there's things that we're both good at, but there's definitely things she's good at that I am not. So I totally get where you're coming from. The other thing I was interested in that you said was someone to manage your inbox. And that's not Leanne's job. She's got but that is Rachel's job. And I do not meet many people who delegate that. And I just don't understand why you, like, every business owner doesn't have somebody at least doing triage on their inbox and clearing out everything that you don't need to see and highlighting the ones that are like, okay, this client needs to be responded to and this thing needs to be handled, and get it from like 200 messages a day down to at least like the top 15 or so that you need to do something with. How long have you been doing it that way?
So that was probably, I think Katie started in 2014. Interestingly, she is not in my inbox now. I am not in deals nearly to the degree now that I was then. And that was the biggest risk then, was that, you know, lost in all the spam and lost in team communications and things like that. An urgent need with a client would escape my grasp or escape my view. So I'm back in my inbox now. But that was a really key part. Like, having somebody that I trusted operationally was really key from getting to 1 to 4 million. And frankly, it will probably be part of getting back to 4 million under Katie's leadership as CEO. We will probably need to get her somebody.
Yes,
at that level, I'm guessing that could happen as soon as next year, for sure.
Yeah, Katie is going to need her own assistant for sure to be able to manage everything coming at her. So, just quickly on Sanford Rose, I've had a Sanford Rose guy on the show before, Yosef Kolish. Do you know Yosef?
Yeah, I love Yosef. Yeah, I've been in a couple small groups with him. Yep.
Okay. So he's someone who, and he and I, you know, chat once in a while and shoot messages back and forth. And we actually have a couple of SRA members in our coaching program as well. So shout out to Dan Toussaint and Kunji Sido, both awesome individuals who I am privileged to work with. So you described, you hinted at a huge upheaval in 2019 because you'd been on this path of growth and really huge success, like to get from scratch to 4 million in itself. And just to clarify, is that all permanent billings or do you do any contract or temporary stuff?
No contract, all permanent placement.
4 million in net fee income is phenomenal. What happened in 2019?
So 2018, we did 3.4 million, I believe. And I had, you know, three partners in place. But I was not sleeping well. I was drinking way too much. I was smoking way too much. I was really unhappy. Right. It was really a stressful environment. And I don't believe that it was just the stress that came from all of the work. There were really significant cultural issues at play. And I was trying to figure it out. And it was clear that we were at a place then that the business was very successful. The team was very independent. And I think there was this question of like, what's next was in front of us. And I had an answer for that, you know, I needed to be true for me and my income and my ambitions for the firm. And the team had answers for that question that were different than mine. And we just couldn't align. That's, you know, that's probably the simplest way to say it. And I was not flexible enough to either, like, I could either stick to my guns and keep pushing for what I wanted. I could, you know, be laissez-faire and let them do what they wanted, or I could engage as leaders often need to, and really engage in a persuasive effort with my team and move them in a, or define a shared direction. And really, you know, when I sort of think back about that time, I really feel like the reason it fell apart was because I approached it from a my way or the highway kind of approach. And the first partner on the highway happened in January, and that was my choice. I felt like that was the right move for the company, for the culture. So I asked one of the partners to leave in January, and by the 1st of May, the other two partners were gone, as were another six or seven people. Like there was a period like in April, late March or April of that year, where it was just like somebody was resigning every week, and it was just heartbreaking. It was awful. It was terrifying. We had just committed to a 5,000 square foot office that was intended to get us to a 30 person team. And, you know, that was not a small investment. I'll stop there. I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, but, in the end, I feel like, you know, in almost every area of life, parenting, my relationship with my wife, my professional relationships, my friendships, there's you always kind of reach this. Anytime there are bumps in the road, and there always will be, you always confront this question, like, would I rather be right or would I rather be happy? And I chose being right. And I think that was the frame of mind that I brought to firm ownership, to firm growth, to being a good recruiter, to being all, you know, lots of great stuff. But I chose right over being happy. And that's the simplest way to say it. And when you choose that, you're alienating people. full stop. You're going to hurt a relationship, and which is fine if those relationships are not important to you. But as a business owner, I would argue that they should be central. Like, those relationships and the depth and quality of the relationships that you have with your people, your team members, that should be central to your life. And that will yield happiness, and I believe will also yield growth.
Mark, first of all, thank you so much for opening up about what must have just been a very traumatic and stressful chapter in the business, and also in your life. Because I think, and I really respect and appreciate you for doing that. I think that's going to be so relatable to people, because everyone has challenges, roadblocks, makes mistakes, screws things up. And to hear that you're not perfect, even though you're very successful, I think actually will make people feel better about their own failings, which we all have as human beings. I don't really understand, though, like, what happened here, because you seem like such an easy guy to get along with. And you hired these folks, right? So I'm assuming you hired them because there was values in common. You had created a culture where, you know, you attracted certain types of folks who, you know, at so they, I just don't, I'm, help me understand where things went wrong. You said, like, you were inflexible, but were they just too asking for more commission, or like, what was the breaking point in the relationship?
More commission came, what was one of the pieces of that first conversation. It wasn't the only piece. And you know, I mean, if you're dealing with producers, you're going to confront questions about commissions all the time. Absolutely. I feel like it's on us as owners to, like, show that we are earning our commissions, like, our cut, right? It's not an insignificant cut. In most cases, especially if you're, you know, building a growing organization without outside capital, you're self-funding your growth. You need to maintain some decent margins. And for good producers, yes, they're going to look at that and say, well, you know, what at Phillips, what are you doing to earn, you know, your 50% or your 60% or whatever. So commissions were a part of it. But really, I feel like the emotional piece was you can navigate those commission conversations. You can navigate questions of fairness and unfairness and who got what and when they got it and who's got, you know, who got the house account, but they're getting paid for, you know, as if it were their own. Like, there's just always that stuff. And if you are navigating that with emotional intelligence, like, you can navigate anything. If you are rigid, and I'm not saying that, like, the converse of rigidity is not just everybody gets what they want and you just say yes to everything. That's not the exactly opposite of that.
Yeah.
But there is a way. I mean, just think of, like, parenting, right? I mean, most firm owners probably have kids. You know, most firm owners probably had a career for some number of years as recruiters, and they have some exposure to parenting, either with their own kids or with people on their team. Yeah. We all know that, like, my way or the highway messaging and postures with kids just yields alienated kids. Like, it's just, it, my wife is, like, the best example of that, and a constant reminder to me. My three boys are all out of the house at this point. We're fairly new empty nesters, But as they were growing up, and especially when they were teenagers and they were butting heads with dad, with a competitive, you know, outcome oriented dad, like she would just constantly remind me, like, Mark, you have to keep the relationship first. Like the relationship right. first, relationship first should be your guiding light. And not everybody is gonna, you know, need the same support. Not everybody's gonna need the same accountability. Not everybody's gonna need the same. If you, your only way of sort of determining what the needs are and what your best offering to them is what's, you know, the relation is having the relationship first. So I hope that I'm not being too vague in an answer to your question, but really, like, the relationship in my mind, when I think about that time, my relationship with those three partners, my relationship with the team members that rolled up to them was not first. And so consequently, like, it's a house of cards. So you could look operationally and say, well, this happened and that happened. You could look from a business perspective and probably find other antecedents. But, you know, in the end, the way that I think about it is it wasn't relationship first. And I will just, you know, I sort of blew past one comment about my drinking. I had moments in my life where I was a big partier. When I talk about drinking a lot, I was not partying as a search for, you know, back in 2018, I was not partying. I was not like out at the bar. I was not like the drinker that you see in movies, but really at a physical, biological level, I was probably hungover every day of the week. Like I was drinking, you know, a bottle of wine a night, which is a lot.
Wow. So it's like a stress release more.
Totally. Totally. But also which created an enormous biological stress. Mm. And the psychological sort of impact of that was what a therapist called dysregulated behavior. And I had never really heard of that before. We talked a lot through that. And it took me a while to sort of wrap my head around what a dysregulated state is and what a regulated state is. And, you know, just to bring it back to the parenting sort of thread, like a dysregulated state is having an argument with my kid. You know, a regulated state is being curious and seeking to understand first and keeping the relationship first. And I think very, you know, I'm using some shorthand there, but you can very, very easily sort of just at a like gut level understand like how different those two postures are. And I really believe that I really believe that I was hungover every day of the week for multiple years, and that led to dysregulated relationships with my team. I am not somebody who says nobody should drink. I'm not somebody who says sobriety is for everybody, but I needed a really big pattern interrupt. And that came for me, first with, tobacco, in earlier in 2019. And then December 16th of 2019 was my last drink of alcohol. So coming up on wow. three years, I guess, alcohol free.
Huge. Wow. That's incredible, Mark.
Thank you. Really the big benefit is I can like engage in these stressful situations in my family, out in the world with politics, or with my team. I can do so in a much more consistently present way. Not that I don't have moments of dysregulation, but it's not just, it's not the like foundation of my emotional engagement with life. And building a firm is stressful. Like there's no way around that. Recruiting is stressful. So, does that help Mark, sort of shed some light on what happened?
Yeah. So what I admire is you're taking ownership and taking responsibility for, you know, the fractures that occurred and led to the sort of unforeseen downsizing of the business, which is ultimately empowering, right? Because if you blame other people, then you have no control. If you take responsibility, then now you can do something to change and to produce a different outcome. So I think that's great. In your defense, though, there is a inherent problem, I believe, with the business model of hiring and seeking to create big billers. And what I mean by that is that the big biller persona, and I don't want to generalize and lump everyone together, but often is more selfish rather than thinking about others, thinking about team, thinking about the company, and doesn't necessarily play nicely with others and aren't necessarily, don't make good leaders necessarily. And so in building a recruiting business, I would always, and again, I've not done it, but based on having worked with hundreds of firm owners who have, you want to recruit people who have the right mindset, values, attitudes, and potential abilities first and foremost, rather than necessarily all being overly obsessed with the cult of big billers. And especially because it then, if you're a significant portion of your revenue is reliant on a small number of people, that's a huge risk, right? Yep. And it also means that from an integrity point of view, if you know someone is not right for the business, or you don't, maybe they're not treating fellow team members right, or maybe they're pushing, they always want more commission or whatever, and they're a prima donna or whatever, then as the owner, if they're bringing in a huge percentage of the revenue, it puts you in a really difficult spot where you have to decide, like, for the good of the business, this person needs to exit, but that is really going to hurt. And like I say, of course, we want everyone to do their best and to make good money. But, you know, I would rather have a business with, 20 average producers and a couple of, big billers rather than 5 super billers. Does that make sense?
100%. And I'm so glad you kind of teased that, because, if I think, and I do think about my business, version 1 and version 2, right? Version 1 imploded in 2019, and we started building version 2 in late 2019. We are not, version 1 was 100% focused on attracting and motivating big billers. And I was good at it. I could hang, and they, I think, looked at me as a kindred spirit, as a kindred big biller. Yes. We are consciously avoiding, it's not that I don't want people to make money, to your point.
Yes.
I do. But we have structured things from, we pay high salaries now. We do not, and I do not pay massive commissions like the traditional, 35, 40, 50% sort of build up on a really low draw where you've got a leveraged salesperson. That's really what you want. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I want people that feel good about their lives. We have now, my team, I think we have four parents of very young children on our team right now, 5. You know what that means. That means kids are sick. That means doctor's appointments. That means school stuff. That means, a whole host of things that most big billers just ignore. Or they have a spouse that just takes care of that stuff, and they're really not engaged in their personal lives. We are really focused on supporting people with a great benefits plan, with a good salary, with a good living, You know, like I would rather, to your point, I would rather have 10 people making $120,000, $150,000 a year than three people making $400,000 a year. Exactly. And I used to really like just sell that big biller story all day long. It's really refreshing not to, honestly. Yeah. So, and the other thing that we did is as a part of the rebuild of version two, we went through that EOS, you know, VTO process, I think it's called. And our first core value is protect the team.
Nice.
Love and it. That means so many things. Like really, when you like play it out, it means so many different things, so many more things even than when Katie and I came up with that as a core value. But we really intentionally wanted to rebuild the firm with people who are cool with each other. And it's, we do not want
absolutely
the most competitive, you know, this job is competitive enough. Yeah. This, you know, we lose deals all the time. Recruiters lose deals all the time. Like there's people take that. I don't need to remind them of that. I don't need to be juicing them. I really felt like, honestly, when we looked back, I felt like the lifespan of a top producer, of a big biller was about 3 years. It's unsustainable. And, you know, I see that dynamic at play in other parts of my life. I'm a big trail runner. And I ran my first 100-mile race this last year. And
whoa,
that's you see,
a long way.
It is. You see, and I didn't finish either. I don't want to oversell that, but I dropped out at 62 miles, which is great.
That's not an amazing accomplishment.
Not what I wanted. But like in the world of like trail running and ultra running, there are so many stories about these people. That just, you know, that burned really bright for 3, 4, 5 years. And then they got injury after injury after injury after injury. There's so many sort of biological supports for having a more measured, sustainable approach to life and to business. And so I'm so glad you brought that up. I probably have gone on too much about it, but the big biller, again, I will celebrate big billing, but I am not architecting my firm around a big biller ever again.
Absolutely. That's such a great insight. Just as a side note, do you listen to the Rich Roll podcast by any chance?
I do. I love Rich Roll. He's okay. A big one. And he he talks a lot about sobriety and the role of sobriety in his life. And he lives near me. He runs in the Santa Monica Mountains.
Big Sur which is kind of, or something. Is that right?
No, further south. He's in Malibu.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I have a quote on my desk from Rich Roll that I pulled out of. It says, you have to seize the few identifiable moments that can change everything, but change requires rigor, specificity, and accountability.
Like it. Fantastic. Yeah. He's got his book is good as well. Finding Ultra. Is there anything else that you're doing differently in the 2.0 version of the firm that, based on your, you know, what you've learned doing it the first time around?
I have somebody whose job it is. She's a consultant, but she works with us about half time. Her job is to train people. That always kind of fell to me, and I would get pulled in multiple different directions and just didn't really didn't offer good, consistent support. So I guess that kind of falls under that theme of the Katie discussion that I had, which is just outsource, constantly look for things to outsource. Because that's the way all of our clients build their businesses.
Of course it is, yeah. They don't try and do absolutely everything themselves, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't scale that way.
Yes. Yeah, so it's so true. So I think like just thinking about like everybody says, well, recruiting is really different. I don't think it has to be that different. And it's only that different if you're an owner who just thinks they know everything and you need to be, you know, sort of in everybody's business 24/7. But if you really can think about like how scaling businesses are built, it's through specialties, right? So we always had dedicated research, and we do now again, but the dedicated training is new. I hired a full-time marketer this year and she ended up moving over into production just because she was really good at it. But
interesting.
That's another example of just saying, hey, here's this capability that our business needs to grow and let's hire around it.
Great.
We're doing our annual planning meeting in a couple of weeks. So I assume that there will be more manifestations of that principle, just, you know, having divisions of labor. There'll be more manifestations about that in our budget and our hiring plan for next year, but I don't know yet what they are. You got to have some people in your business that are operationally minded and that can document that stuff, right? So we've tried to be really good about having SOPs for everything. And I'm terrible at following SOPs, but I'm good at like, I will be held accountable to them. You know, if somebody says, well, you know, we just wrote that last week, then I'm like, oh shoot, I needed to pay more attention there, you know? And I think the other part of that hypothesis playing out in version two is tied back to promoting Katie to run our business. Like we just had a $500,000 quarter, which is our biggest quarter in version two. So that's a 2 million annual run rate. My hypothesis is that this industry is probably about a $5 million business. But I think that all the tools are in place and the talent is in place to get from two to five. And so I'm stepping out. I'm giving Katie the responsibility, the accountability. I will be a very active board member and mentor to her. But I really think our education technology business, you know, as it's defined now, has everything it needs to grow. And really my big job is to get out of the way. And then, you know, and now I'm pivoting or will pivot, you know, fully January 1st to evaluating new markets, looking at new specialties, and really kind of playing a more strategic growth role for the firm.
That's so cool, Mark. So listen, some of the stuff we're talking about in terms of scaling, our listeners might be interested. We have a webinar that Joel and I hosted called How to Build an Eight-Figure Recruitment Business That Runs Without You. And we go into our nine pillars of a scalable recruitment business. So if anyone listening wants to watch that webinar or download slides, it's recruitmentcoach.com/scale. And Mark, I'll send it to you as well, just in case you're interested. It's kind of our version of EOS, like specifically for recruiting firms. So you'll recognize like some, we've got a flywheel with nine pillars. They're different to the EOS ones, but it just gives you that structured way of thinking about, well, these are the drivers of building a business and I need to be mindful of each one of these nine dimensions. And then there's kind of a, you know, action plan for each of those pillars. So, Mark, thank you so much. I've loved getting to meet you and it was a really rich conversation. I appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity and it's always good to sort of have a chance to sort of reflect on things and sort of tell the story again. And I have a couple takeaways that I'll take back into my own practice and into my team. I can't wait to review that those nine pillars that you put together. And I'm so grateful for the interest and for the great conversation. And thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I'm grateful as well. And let's keep in touch.
All right, sounds good. Take care, Mark.